we would be liking to talk about the day 8th of March. What does it mean for us? How is it important for us? And yeah, and for me, in the last days, I have heard about a lot of demonstration, a lot of split in the left groups, feminists. And I was really surprised to see as well that it's a... For me, it is like the feminist solidarity here. It follows like trends, like it is the trends, which is what's going on in the Middle East or around the world. Like in Afghanistan in 2021, when Taliban took the power there. So there is a lot of talk about it. And now not anymore either, even if it's still like... the situation in Afghanistan, but it seems like it was mattering for 1 year and then not that much anymore. And as well after the revolution in Iran, so with the motto Jinjiyan Azadi, so that there is like in the feminist 8th of March, there is really a big demonstration. It was like the topic was the highlight. And recently I have heard about the Bündnis in Berlin that they did like a call for a demonstration with the focus in Gaza. And I was really like trying to find if any others are included, but there is no other information. And I just wanted to hear your perspectives about this topic. How you feel about it, or how do you see it? And do you agree that it's following trends?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, the 8th of March should be a day of resilience, of common struggles, but also of common resistance and solidarity and feeling safe, you know? And let me say one thing very, very clearly about the whole situation in Gaza and the situation for women. It's undoubtedly clear, and it has been proven by so much research, that in general, war is something that exorbitantly affects women and children. And it is clear that the women of Gaza are systematically suffering, because this is how war works. In a patriarchal world where the care labor of women is taken for granted, it is clear that an extreme situation like a war is specifically going to target women. So that is not in question. But what, you know, to what you're saying, what I think are the two levels why I do not believe any one of these people really gives, to be honest, a shit about women in Gaza, is A, the blatant hypocrisy. Like, there were no specific 8th of March protests in solidarity for Afghanistan, for Iran, or anything. Actually, especially with Iran, we saw in the first months of the protests that so many people were like gaslighting what was happening. So many people were like, yeah, I don't know. Are you sure that it's like that? Are you sure that it was because of the hijab? What did she do? Like, you know, like people really had to prove what was going on. And still there was not this huge response in the West. And there were not a few, but quite many leftists that were bringing up the thought that this might be some CIA scheme or whatever, some conspiracy, yada, yada, yada. So the hypocrisy is blatant. The hypocrisy is blatant. And I do not buy solidarity from a hypocritical person, right? And the second level is connected to that hypocrisy, the suffering of women in Gaza is connected to the general situation in the Middle East. If you are very nicely, cleanly separating what is happening in Gaza from not only the 7th of October and the Hamas genocide in Israel, the genocidal attacks, the femicides, the sexual violence that is completely denied by so many. Not only that, but you're separating it from everything that is happening in the Middle East, from decades of regressive development hand in hand with capitalist development and imperialism. Imperialism clearly not only by the United States, but also by Russia, by China, by all of these actors. So what you're telling me is that basically you very nicely want to separate a conflict that is neither politically not morally separable from everything else that is going on. And that's bullshit. That's bullshit. If you really care about the women of Gaza, you would have cared about them when they stood up and they protested against Hamas last summer and did so all the time. You would listen to feminist voices that tell you what Islamists do. And if Islamists tell you they feel like women are worth less than men, when this is specifically enshrined in their laws and doctrines, if they have specifically shown you in Afghanistan, in the genocide of ISIS against the Yazidi woman, and all of these cases, what they do to women, how femicide is a specific strategy of war by them, then believe them. Believe them when they tell you in the first place. And that is why I do not buy it. That's why I think this is a huge projection. We see all of these leftist people that should look straight in the eye of some of the biggest problems that Europe is facing right now, whether it be the blatant shift to the right in all of the European countries, whether it be natural catastrophes due to climate change, the housing crisis, the price crisis, and inflation, the labor market crisis, all of these things. And you're just completely ignoring that, and you're just making a little conflict in the Middle East, little by size and place, because let's be honest, so many people are killed, but it's not yet remotely the deadliest conflict in the Middle East, let alone in the world. So you take this conflict and you cleanly separate it from everything else, and you make it the space of your projection, because you projecting to this little thing where you think you know it all, where you think you can separate good or bad, makes you also not have to do anything here in Europe. So I think this is a big story of not only hypocrisy, but also people in the West, and quite frankly, extremely privileged people in the West. And I'm not only talking about white people, I'm talking about second, third, fourth generation people of migrant origin in Germany that act like they are the most oppressed person in the group, in the world, completely projecting everything to that. And that's the problem. Conflicts are complicated. No one is forcing you to engage in them. But if you want to engage in them, do that in a matter that is factually right, that is researched, and that is looking for solutions. And I don't know if people have not realized it, but demanding that another country be wiped off the face of the earth is not only unrealistic, but it is specifically anti-Semite when it is the only Jewish state on the face of the earth that you want to have eradicated, but you have no problems with whatever 22 Muslim states, which by majority are fascist.
Thank you for mentioning that, and it is as well for me interesting to see that as well here in Europe, like the demonstrations are especially in Germany, that white feminists ignoring the fact about what's happening right now in Sudan and other countries, and the fact that this is the focus. And as well, like romanticizing the Arabic world, wearing kufiya, which would I would like to mention it. And I just felt like this is like hijacking 8th of March and not to include others, especially those who's affected from radical Islamic country. And yeah, like the topic of hijacking the 8th of March and making it as a focus of one point, and this is the only point that it matter and we should talk about. True, important, but we need to talk about as well other things, and we need to be able to criticize as well. And this is like not existing to criticize in this moment about anything is happening. It is like, no, you are taking away the focus. I was so surprised to meet a German white woman wearing the kufiya. And she, as you know, that I'm from Saudi Arabia, she just like started telling me that she wished her all her life to go to Ulab there. And this is really important because she is representing one person in so many who has no idea about what's going on. She mentioned to me, like in my face, I wish to go to Ula, but it's nice. And she's happy about the a new king that he's allowing European to have like a visit and giving them a tourist visa. And I started to, it breaks my heart, and was like, but there is so much going on behind your Instagram and social media. There is a lot of suffering, and still there are sufferings from middle and women in the Middle East, but as well, especially where I come from, what I know about it. And she said, like, my visit there won't change the situation. And that was like a smash in my face. I realized that this kufiya is... people wearing it without even knowing anything. What does it represent? It's just like, I will wear it, I will hide my racism and anti-Semitism, and like, you know, to hear it, to wear it to cover something else, and not being able to talk deeply about any topic.
It just tells you everything you need to know about white feminism as a system where it's not about ending oppression, but switching oppression in a way that it suits you. And this is something very much established by white women, but I think it has gotten much, much bigger as a strategy, and I will talk about this in a bit. But, you know, the thing is just like, you know, white women have realized that, you know, and it's clear, like, if you're a white woman, you are facing the standard systematic, like misogynistic and patriarchal oppression and exploitation that you just statistically face in Europe, right? That doesn't just disappear like that. But what is happening is that by globalizing their perspective, they are just looking for places where they will be the people that are better off. And the Middle East is such a nice place for that. You know, all of these people talk about Orientalism and yada, 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 but they will never like admit to the love marriage and the massive reciprocal deflection of the Middle East vis-a-vis Europe. While all of these countries were established, while all of the countries of the Middle East were established. And so, white women have a specific role in all of this. And so women like this, they really nicely realize that they get privilege in the Middle East. They are the object of desire in the Middle East. In the Middle East, they can get male privilege because of their white privilege. They can profit off of that. And so they're very, very intelligent about that. But if you look at it, this type of strategy is also changing and is adapted by many other groups. So for example, when it comes to racism in Germany, you see that more and more the matter of racism is made to be something that has something to do with religion. And so indirectly, people want to make people Muslims by proxy by saying, okay, they're being treated badly because they are identified as Muslim. But who is proving that? Like, Christian Iraqi person will be read as the same thing as a Muslim Iraqi person in Germany. Who's proving that? But here again, it's systems of privilege trying to just make themselves a better position instead of ending oppression altogether. And so, Islam as a global hegemonial, and by the way, the fastest growing religious community in the world, can we just remember that? Like, this is not like just one small marginalized group, it's like a huge group. This group tries to take its global privilege and turn it into something that gives you privilege in the smaller level of oppression in Europe as well. And that's kind of what this kind of white people are doing as well. And I mean, also with all of the symbolism, like, I mean, maybe you can tell people, what does a keffiyeh mean in Saudia, or let's say in general in the Khaliji countries? Like, because a keffiyeh is not something that people wear in all the Arab countries, right? Like, let's be clear about that.
Yes, and
It's
not all
something,
genders.
exactly, it's a specific geographically and gender coded thing. So maybe you can talk about that first, what that actually means.
Yes, I would like to mention about it that the keffiyeh, it has a category and it is, has an origin, and it the origin, as I know, it has come from Kufa, the area in Iraq. And it has the colors represent different things. Like in Saudi Arabia, they call it shimar, and they wear it differently. Like it's mostly in the head, and as well in Emirates and Jordan and Iraq, and they have it as well in Yazidi and in Iran, and they have it as well in Kurdistan and Lebanon. There is different colors. Like there is the white color. It is another version of shimar, which is where as well, like in specific areas in the Middle East. But the shimar, which I am expert about shimar now, or I know about it, like this color terrifies me, and the reason behind that, I know it's a fashionable piece of materialist link, like you know, to represent something, but it's for me, it represents completely something, the opposite. It's mostly worn by men in the region in Saudi Arabia, and it samples manhood, patriarchy, honor, power. It's common worn in the head. So if a man sometimes, like in the in Riyadh, when a man don't wear that, they say he's a foreigner or he is a gay. He's not considered as well, like you know, as the way they can categorize things or something like that. So for me, it represents as well the sexual violence. Men may use the shimar to cover their victims or themselves while sexual violence to prevent them from recognizing the victims. And I have with that. So it is an easy piece to fast react to hide the face. And it is like transformed with years. Before, it was used to cover from the dust from the area or something like that. And it comes as well from North Africa. The way that people use a piece of fabric to protect themselves, but now it's used in a completely patriarchal, brutal way. In honor killing ceremony, as known as femicide in that countries, the traditions is involved covering the woman's face with the shimar. It is an act of resampling or reclaiming the honor of the man after the woman is dead. They cover her, and then that's it. Completely another representation about this piece of
Totally.
So. And I think like I asked for some sensitivity when I see people wearing it. I ask them if they understand what does it mean.
No, totally. And I mean, to be honest, like, I mean, for them, it's clearly just like a sign of edginess. Like, they do not put just even a little bit of research into what these things mean. But, on the other side, I'm thinking, like, fair enough. Like, let's say that you have a symbol and it belongs to traditionally to men or to patriarchy. Like, let's say in a first wave feminism kind of way, wearing pants instead of a skirt, because you say, okay, I am like reappropriating the male clothing style or whatever, or like cross dressing or whatever. Like, that's fair enough. And if you look at Kurdish history, this is actually what happened. Like, the Kurdish the Kurdish version of the kufiya, the jamana, kind of that men would wear on their head. We also have different colors and have different significations. But over the years, especially as the female resistance established itself in the 80s, it has more and more just become a symbol of resistance, because it was just the typical shawl that these people would wear, right? And so it was appropriated by the woman, was appropriate by them in their fight, and so more and more would wear it during protests. And this happened with many other shawls. There's many other shawls that have been traditionally Kurdish in specific regions, and they have been worn by resistance fighters, and they became a symbol, just like also like the colored shawl that you see of the Kurdish women in Syria, for example, which used to be a shawl that rather women wore in these regions. And it's very, it's not only like it's very spread, it's not only in these regions, but women in the Balkans wear this type of shawl. Women in Russia wear it. It's the colored one with the flowers on it. And then it was turned around and men started wearing it as well in the Rojava revolution, and kind of, also signified that this was also a feminist fight. But I do not see that work of taking and reappropriating and positively attributing something to this symbol of clothing in the Palestinian case. The Palestinian struggle had all of these last decades to prove that it is a Marxist one or a feminist one or whatever. But all it did, all of these decades, quite frankly, is just using the vocabulary of different movements that were en vogue at this time, and just, kind of making their thing out of it, but like specifically, substantially not changing anything. That is why the movement could so easily be taken over by Islamist forces and Islamist groups throughout the 80s and the 90s, and turned to a mostly Islamist slash, just classic patriarchal autonomist movement like the Fatah in the West Bank. So if you have not done the homework of really trying to change the meaning, so I can really believe you that you wear this keffiyeh not as a male nationalist symbol, but you wear it as a emancipatory symbol. If I don't see that work having been done in the reality, then I just don't buy it. Then I don't buy that it is a system, it is a symbol that I can interpret differently. And that's the problem about it.
Yes, it's problematic. And I remember in our previous phone call when you said it's like a Deutsche gegen Deutsche. They just wear it to provoke each other. And as well, the samples, it has no other meanings. It is misusing as well political situations in other country and to express or to split with each other because of two other reasons about that. Talking about splittings, it's really interesting. As I said, in Berlin, that there is a Zweibündnis, there is a two demonstration, and as well in Leipzig and other cities. But I have as well read a text, an aufruf about it. And part of the text was saying, as well, specifically talking why there is a split, or why do they have to, it's extra work to create an extra Bündnis, to extra things, because you can't just go along with the others who's doing their demonstration. And it's because of so many other reasons. But one of them, it was this movement, like Me Too movement. And they wrote a text, it's called Me Too, Unless You Are a Jew. And it is talking and criticizing this unrecognized sexual violences that happened as well in the 7th of October. I read in one Twitter channel for Nahu Wa'i Nasawi, it is like a feminist awareness, and they gave some, always they post stuff, and they posted a lot recently about Sudan and this sexual violences and the situation there, because at the end the women are the victim of the war, like, you know, they are treated like objects in every conflict. Back to the topic of denying sexual violences, this page, they wrote something that shocked me, which says the sexual violence condemned by the victims in 7th October, it's actually a propaganda and it has nothing to do with it, and it's lies and so on. That there is always the possibility that the sexual violences happen, and we can't just deny it because we have... like not believing what this person and this person said because they are political and la la la. Are you reading about any other other languages, like feminist movements who's talking about the sexual violences that happened?
Yeah, I mean, like, the problem is exactly that, is that we specifically have a situation where we see that a specific kind of double language and a misogyny is kind of reproduced. And that's a huge problem in the Arab feminist left. I must say, in the Kurdish case, it's a little bit different, because, like, the mass sexual violence of Islamists is absolutely not deniable. Like, as a Kurd, you don't need to like Israel to admit to what happened, because you have seen it firsthand. You have seen it firsthand with ISIS. You have seen it firsthand with their genocide against the Islamic State. But you have seen it before with all of these regimes that are oppressing us. Like, you have seen clearly what Iran, for example, is doing to female political prisoners, many of them women, since the 80s, where the regulation says that they must be raped before their execution, because otherwise they're gonna go to heaven. You know it very clearly if you look at another Muslim majority country, Turkey, which has been very engaged in its sexual violence when they were raiding Kurdish villages, destroying them, but also acting against Kurdish political prisoners. And you know this very well also from the Mukhabarat, from all the secret services of Iraq and Syria, and how they have been treating women, how they have been doing this stuff. So you cannot really deny any of it. Like, and make no mistakes, like, Kurds have no reason to specifically like the Israeli state. Like, they admit to what happened because they cannot deny that the people that perpetrated this, Hamas, and in general, patriarchal men in the Middle East, that this is just happening. You know, this is a reality, that this has happened too often that you could deny this. And sadly, this is the reality of Arab feminism, and it's just taking no accountability and treating patriarchy like it's something that happens just by accident. Like, you know, our men, they just need to be developed a little bit more, educated a little bit more, and then they will finally stop attacking us, because then they will just do something else. But it doesn't work like that. And I think I told you as well in our call before, but I think one of the great examples for that is what Nawal al-Saadawi actually did regarding one of her visits to Kurdistan. And so for the people that don't know her, Nawal al-Saadawi is like pretty much the biggest feminist icon in the Arab world. She's from Egypt, which is unfortunately one of the capitals of the Middle East of rape and sexual violence and the most public places. And she has written all of these amazing books, which I personally also identified with very much growing up. And she was in Kurdistan, in Iraqi Kurdistan. She was in Halabja, where in 1988 Saddam Hussein attacked the civilian population with chemical gas and killed thousands of people at that point during his genocidal campaign. And she was there, and she left a note in the guest book. And in the guest book, she said, "I am commemorating all the victims of American imperialism." So, what do you want to tell me as a feminist if you write that? You want to tell me that all Arab men are innocent, that they cannot have accountability, and that if they do something bad, actually it's the fault of someone else. And this is a very prevalent framing of people like Saddam Hussein, that he just became like this because the Americans armed him. He just became this genocidal, horrible dictator because the West supported him. So that's a logic of no accountability. And feminism, a feminism that has no accountability specifically, does not demand accountability from men just because of their race. That's highly dangerous. That's highly, highly, highly dangerous. And I think this is why these discourses are so completely disturbing, because also, like, everyone in the West talks about intersectionality, blah, blah, blah. Like, Middle Eastern feminism is, especially the Arab version, is the least intersectional thing that you can imagine. They don't care about class struggles. They don't care about whether women of ethnic minorities and religious minorities are specifically persecuted. It is like a fight between an Arab woman and an Arab man. But as soon as a third party comes in, Israeli woman, Kurdish woman, whatever, minorities, this and that, they all stick together. And that's not how feminism works.